WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave. Leonore Tiefer is a sexologist. She says there's very little honest conversation about sex in our culture. So many people, perhaps most people, find that their sexual experience falls far short of what they hope for and what they believe others may be experiencing. Tiefer says that even avid readers of self-help books or pop magazines are misguided by the unrepresentative stories presented there. Her book, Sex is Not a Natural Act, tries to place our sexual practices and sexual anxieties in a larger social and cultural context. Tiefer has taught sexuality courses for graduate students, as well as medical and nursing students, evaluated almost 2,000 patients with sexual complaints, provided sex therapy and psychotherapy for individuals and couples, and briefly wrote columns for newspapers and magazines. Terry Gross interviewed Leonore Tiefer in February of 1995. They discussed sexual fantasies, masturbation, and cultural attitudes about sexuality. Their conversation was straightforward and sometimes explicit, so be advised.
Why do you think people are so uncomfortable talking about masturbation?
I think that there are several reasons. The one that people will give you straightforward is that there are many places in religious literature and doctrine that says that it's wrong. And so people are very comfortable saying this is bad, this is wrong, and they can cite chapter and verse, literally, to support that. But what I think happens is that so much of sexual discussion is tinged by embarrassment and discomfort and shame and awkwardness, that it's a relief to have a topic where you can say, and it's wrong, and somehow justify your embarrassment and awkwardness and shame and discomfort. I think that masturbation symbolizes sex for the sheer pleasure of it. It's just unbridled pleasure. It's got no other justification. I mean, you can read advice books, and they will try to dignify it by saying, and if you masturbate, you'll get in touch with your body, and this will help you when you finally meet Mr. Right. But the fact of the matter is, what you learn about your body in masturbation is less than what you learn in the shower. So I think the only justification for the thing is that it feels good. And our culture has a long tradition of not feeling so good about saying that it's perfectly all right to just engage in activities that have no, sexual activities particularly, that have no purpose, no dignified love, bonding, sanctity of marriage, nothing other than it just is a nice thing to do. It helps you go to sleep. It whiles away the time. It reduces anxiety.
I always figured one of the reasons why people are so embarrassed talking about it or admitting to it was like worse than saying you didn't have a date on a Saturday night. You know, that like you had no other option.
Yes.
And it said something bad about you.
Yes. I mean, the implication is that it's a second best kind of a thing, and that anybody with any social qualifications at all would have another person to do this with and wouldn't have to do it alone. It's like drinking alone or anything alone. I mean, when you think about it, our society is very oriented towards getting people somehow to value doing stuff together more than to doing stuff alone. And sex is certainly one of them. But the idea is that you only have so much to spare. And if you're going to masturbate, it's obviously because you don't have a partner to do it with. But Gagnon's research showed that that wasn't true, that sex is more a sort of a more you get, the more you want kind of a thing. The less you get, the less you want, rather than, you know, there's exactly 72 acts per month available and you can distribute them however your life allows you.
Now, as part of your work as a sexologist, you've worked with a lot of individuals and with couples.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think if one or both members of a couple are masturbating, that maybe is a sign that there's something wrong in the sex life of the couple?
Look, Terry, the rule in sex is anything is possible. So if you ask, could it maybe be a sign? Yes, anything could be a sign. Sex is a social phenomenon that is done for many motivations, many reasons, fits into lives in an infinite number of ways. So could there be a sign that it's a problem? Yes. Could there be a sign that one person is has a problem and the other one doesn't? Yes. Anything is possible. But is it automatically a sign of that? No.
Now, you actually make a connection between crusades against pornography and fears of masturbation. How are the two connected in your mind?
Well, the main use of pornography is for masturbation. Everybody knows that. When you see all of this stuff, the New York Times, I mean, I can't believe the New York Times has gotten on a thing where it actually uses the word smut in its headlines. Somehow I thought the word smut had gone out a long time ago. But anyway, when you see all of this anti-pornography news and legislation and tirades and so on, they never talk about masturbation. They talk about how it harms people's minds, warps them. They go out, they do bad things, but they don't actually discuss that the main use is for masturbation. And I think that a lot of the fuel for the anti-pornography crusades comes from what we were talking about earlier. This sort of almost universal anxiety and awkwardness about admitting that people masturbate.
You've written that suppression of pornography deprives people of learning more about the human imagination.
Yes.
What do you feel you've learned about the human imagination from pornography?
Well, I've learned it in the same way as in novels or other fictional depictions, how motives and individual personality expressions are sort of converted by the fictional imagination, my fiction, you know, the person, not always the author so much, but the reader's imagination. Let me give you an example from a case that I had where a woman, I can't tell all the details, just it would take 4 hours, but suffice it to say that she was not having a good sexual relationship with her husband, but she was masturbating, and her favorite fantasy had to do with her dancing naked in a room filled with sort of seedy men. It was a seedy room, a crummy carpeting, and everybody, you know, sort of had 2 days' growth of beard, and you could tell that the place smelled from beer, and it was like seedy, archetypal seedy. Well, we talked about that a lot, and it had a lot to do with her kind of, you know, like most women, wanting to be attractive, wanting to be powerful through being looked at. A woman has this sense that if she walks into a room, men should notice, men should get turned on, not necessarily wildly aroused, but a little bit turned on. But I mean, I would think that most women, heterosexual women, might think that if they were going to take their clothes off in a room and dance around, that it would turn men on. And I thought that this was a very empowering fantasy. Now, she initially saw it as degrading. I mean, why am I in this seedy room? Well, it turned out that this fantasy, that she didn't feel entitled to this sense of power. She didn't feel good about it. She came from a rather orthodox religious background, and certainly the idea of turning men on was not something she'd ever been given permission to feel powerful doing. So she had to do it in her fantasy in such a way that it was crummy, degraded, if you want to use the popular word, but seedy I like better. So she did it in this seedy way, in this seedy place, but by God, she got her power in there.
Do you find that the women who you see in your practice often have sexual fantasies that turn them on but also upset them?
Yes, well, like this one. This fantasy upset this woman quite a bit. She wanted, I don't know what she wanted to do, look like Annette Funicello dancing around or something, you know, something really classy or middle class upscale, not seedy.
Do you often hear fantasies that have to do with being raped?
Forced to do sexual things is a common element in women's fantasy.
But you're making a separation between that and the word rape.
Well, Rape, what is rape? Rape is forced to be doing sexual things, but I guess I want to put it in that language, first of all, because the word, you know, the words we use in sex are so overdetermined. And you say the word rape, we have 42 million associations, and we're already polarized and holding our lances pointing towards each other. But if I say forced to do sexual things, well, at least that opens up a conversational area that's not already, you know, corralled and organized. A lot of times, fantasies of both men and women include being forced to do sexual things. And I think that that's because in our society, people do not grow up feeling just terrifically fine about doing sexual things, having oral sex, having sex outdoors, having sex with famous people. They're not encouraged. So people can have a perfectly undistorted, unsymbolic fantasy about skiing with the president, but to have a fantasy about having sex with the president, they might have to be forced to have sex with the president. So that's kind of how it works.
If someone has a fantasy of something that they know would disturb them in real life,
yes,
does that mean that the fantasy is a sign of some kind of pathology? I mean, do you think it's acceptable to have fantasies that may be pleasing to you as fantasies, but if it happened to you in real life, it would be absolutely horrible?
I think this is commonly what fantasy is about. I mean, you're talking about a lot of people's fantasies. This woman with the CD dancing. I mean, if she was, you know, grabbed off of the street, stuffed in the back of a Buick and taken to a crummy motel and forced, I mean, this is what fantasy is about in sex.
Well, how do you explain that? I don't know if you can, but do you try to explain that?
To people, I tell them how it's just the mind's way of getting what it wants, but acknowledging that it doesn't feel entitled to get it.
One more question about pornography. How concerned are you about violent pornography where women are the victims?
I'm as concerned about it as I'm concerned about other violent expressions in society. I think there's too much violent movies, you know, people getting shot through the forehead with an AK-47. That's, I mean, disgusting, horrible. I deeply regret it. I'm concerned about all violent expressions, and I'm concerned about all degrading expressions. Women being used in advertisements for computers. You know, this woman will be happy to type on your computer for the next 60 hours. You know, nobody's going to be happy doing that. Their eyes and their hands are going to go to hell. So I think that there's lots of expressions of misogyny. Some are violent, some are not. And I'm opposed to them all, but I'm not in favor of censorship. I work with the National Coalition Against Censorship, for example, because censorship is one of the favorite ways of attacking sexuality, all kinds of sexuality. I mean, it starts with, hey, let's get bad sexuality, but then it's very hard to define what's bad sexuality. So then you get masturbation, because a lot of people are going to say that's bad sexuality. And then you get thinking about kids being sexual. Everyone's going to say, well, kids are not sexual. Forget that. Anything to do with kids and sex is automatically bad. And, you know, it just spreads and spreads. So that what do you teach in sex education? You teach the lady has the ovaries and the gentleman has the testes. Thank you, class. I mean, that's all you teach.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Leonore Tiefer, and she teaches in the Department of Urology and Psychiatry at Albert Einstein College of Medicine. She's the author of the new book, Sex is Not a Natural Act. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with Leonore Tiefer, author of the new book, Sex is Not a Natural Act. You write that for most people, sexual experience falls short of what they hoped for and what they believe others may be experiencing.
Yes.
What are some of the typical differences between the disappointments that men and women express to you?
I see men, patients, and they come in because they can't perform intercourse. They're having some sort of erectile difficulty most of the time. And so they focus their disappointment on somehow their performance inadequacy. That if only I could perform almost robotically or like an automaton. You know, every time, without question, with complete confidence, without hesitation, then that would really meet their expectations. Whereas women come in, and again, these are not women who are coming in because they themselves have a problem. Maybe if I was working in a different place, hearing different stories, it might come across this way. But since the women I see are coming in without themselves necessarily complaining of a problem, they come in saying, all right, so we can have intercourse, so he has an erectile problem. Why does he have to avoid all sexual interaction? Why can't we have a little cuddle here and there? Why can't we have a little oral sex? Why can't we have at least touching and kissing and holding? So we can't do the whole thing, so who cares? I want to feel desired. I want to feel close. And I'm not getting that.
So do then you try to talk to the man about being more loving, even though, you know, being more physical, even if it doesn't lead to intercourse?
I used to.
You stopped? Why?
I gave up. I only have one contact. Well, really two, or mostly one. Interview opportunity with these men.
Mm-hmm.
You cannot change a lifetime of indoctrination in one conversation. It's really rude to even think that you could, because I was arrogant at the beginning. I thought, hey, these men don't know that cuddling is swell. I'm just going to tell them. Well, forget about it. You cannot change a lifetime of indoctrination with a single conversation. And so, you know, I toss it in. But they run right over it with their Mack truck of I've got to have an erection or I'm not a man, and they don't even hear you.
What about generational differences? Do you find that young people have a completely different set of problems than middle-aged people?
Yes. I think that young people are under much more pressure than older people because they see the sex in a relationship as a make-or-break element. They see the sex in terms of their own adequacy. They have much higher standards. You no longer just have to have intercourse and, whew, okay, I did that. I'm okay. I'm normal. Now you got to kind of be Nureyev, a little bit of foreplay, you know, and a little conversation and a little oral sex and turn them around upside down. So the expectations are much higher. And there seems to be, you know, there's always a lot of people who are anxious and a lot of people who are just nervous. And so they're nervous about this. And so I wish that the people who were nervous could just scale down their expectations. So sex shouldn't be such a big deal for them. They should go back to plan A, where somehow, you know, just getting it done was adequate.
I think this leads us to the title of your book, which is Sex is Not a Natural Act. Why not?
I'm so glad you asked me that, because if there's one thing I feel I have to say that perhaps your average, ordinary sex therapist is maybe an oxymoron, it talks about is I think that one of the most oppressing elements in our whole rhetoric about sexuality is the idea that it's natural. Natural meaning you don't have to learn, you don't have to practice, you don't need feedback. It's just like unrolling a carpet. There it is, and it's perfect, and that's the way it is, and don't worry about a thing. When the time is ready, honey, you'll do it. And that's just baloney. There's no red carpet in there. The whole thing is a complicated, kind of lifelong process of adjustment, adaptation, development, interaction. And it's extremely related to the culture and the historical period and the values of where a person and a couple are. So I think that if we were to see sexuality as fundamentally socially constructed, that we would have a much more robust attitude towards the need for sexuality education of a rich sort rather than just kind of a pathetic organ-grinding sort. And I think that we'd be much more interested in all of the different manifestations as expressions of the human personality instead of just pathology. You know, it's like if you think of sex like respiration, you got two choices. It's either normal or something's broken. But if you think of sex like music, well, then you're ready. You're interested in culture. You're interested in individual differences in breath control and hand span. You're interested in how many hours a week did you practice. You're interested in a lot of more interesting questions just than is it fixed or is it broken. I think sexuality is more like spirituality and more like musicality and less like respiration and digestion.
That there's many different ways it can be expressed.
That's right. It's fundamentally a cultural phenomenon. Of course, it's done with the body. Playing the piano is done with the body. But when you open a book on music, the first chapter isn't the bones of the hands. Whereas if you open a book on sex, the first chapter is, and the clitoris is connected to the labia, is connected to... It's not about how human beings express themselves, how culture varies, how learning takes place, how conditioning takes place, how come people in India play the tabla and people in America play the snare drum. You don't see that in a sex book. You see, you know, the knee bones connected to the ankle bone.
Leonor Tiefer is a sex researcher and associate professor of urology and psychiatry at the Albert Einstein Medical Center in New York. Her book is called Sex is Not a Natural Act. She spoke with Terry Gross in February of 1995. This is Fresh Air.